the craziest thing is then watching everybody in the room leave. And it's just Medea, me, and our daughter. And we're just on this bed. And now we're parents. And nobody told us like how we're supposed to feel, what we're supposed to do. And we're just looking at this alien in between us. Like, so now we have to take care of this thing.
Welcome to the Dadwell Podcast. I'm your host, Antonio Garcia. Dadwell & Company is an independent media project at the intersection of creativity and fatherhood. The Dadwell Podcast features makers, artists, musicians, authors, filmmakers, and designers who are raising the creative bar while simultaneously raising small humans. Today, I'm talking creativity and fatherhood with writer and director Brad Bischoff. Named one of Filmmaker Magazine's 25 New Faces of Independent Film, Brad is an award-winning director whose work has been screened in major film festivals, staff picked on The Atlantic, Vimeo, Short of the Week, and YouTube. He is an alumni of the Telluride Film Festival Student Symposium and Columbia College Chicago, and just wrapped on what is to be his debut feature film, The Grasshopper. Brad is dad to his 4-year-old daughter and 2-year-old son. In this episode, Brad talks about the myriad odd jobs he's held to make ends meet and make movies happen. From working at a skate park, to packaging incontinence briefs, to transcribing detectives' interviews at 100 words per minute. We talk about his remarkable success and luck as a student filmmaker and how much his life feels like scenes from a John Hughes script. He also opens up about the sacrifices he's made for his films and the tolls they've taken on his health, his family, and his marriage. As you might imagine, Brad is a master storyteller, which made this episode especially tough to edit, but particularly enjoyable to get lost in. Oh man, how are you feeling? You just had an emergency appendectomy.
Yeah, just because everything that's been going on in my life for the past few months has been totally insane, and I feel like this was the last sort of a closing of a chapter. And it was like it had to happen to me. It was like an internal thing. When it happened, Medea was gone. I was in charge of the kids. And it was right after we had wrapped the film, and I woke up with just this intense pain in my stomach. And yeah, I checked myself into the ER. They were just like, "I can't believe you're not in more pain." Like apparently my appendix was about to burst. And they rushed me straight into a emergency surgery. I had it removed. Literally, as of like yesterday or the day before, I'm like feeling back to some sort of normalcy, walking around, running around. But it's just been a week of recovery.
Yeah, man. I'm glad that you didn't try to like muscle through it or something and be like, "Oh yeah, I can just sleep this off." That you, I feel like a lot of people are like, "Oh, that doesn't feel good, but I'll give it some time."
Well, it's funny you say that because I mean, I did. I kind of gave it like a week, man. Like I gave it like a week. When we wrapped the film, I was still in Chicago. The next day I woke up with this pain. It was really hard to sleep. It's just this like shooting. I thought it was just digestion, but this pulsing pain in my stomach. And somehow I was able to get to sleep and I woke up and I felt a lot better. And I was like, "Oh, that was weird. Maybe I was just, it's just compounded stress. I haven't slept in a month and a half. I've been eating like crap." And then we boarded the plane that day, came back to California where we're living. And like 3 more days had passed. And then Medea was leaving for a trip to New Orleans. So I was going to be in charge of the kids. And then literally the day she left, I checked myself into the ER that day because the pain was just too heavy. But it's kind of forced me to sit down and just hang out, you know, with my family and my friends and just sit here and not do a million things. Like I literally just have to be and exist. In some weird way, it's a blessing. It's like the perfect end to this chapter for sure.
Yeah, it's funny how our bodies kind of work up until your brain goes like, "All right, cool, finally finished that." And then the body's like, "Oh, for real?" And the brain's like, "Yeah, dude, we're done." And the body's like, "Well, fuck it, because I've been holding on to all of this and I'm about to drop it. If you give me the clearance, I'm about to ruin this person's life." And I feel like that's how it is. Like you survive some crazy work thing or an insane schedule shooting your very first feature film. And then your body's like, "Okay, cool. Are we done? All right, great. Because I'm coming apart right now."
Yeah, man. Isn't it funny? Like it really makes you think too of how powerful your body is in that way. you know, apparently that had been going on inside me throughout the shoot, and I just didn't feel it. Nothing mattered, you know, and I was able to get through anything. There was no pain, but as, like you said, as soon as we wrapped, it was, everything came to the surface.
Yeah. It's like you're traveling, and then as soon as you're done traveling, you get sick, or like you're doing some crazy strenuous thing that takes like all of your effort. And as soon as it's done, you know, some part of you just gives up, you know, physically. It's just
survival mode.
Yeah. It's pretty remarkable. Well, yeah, man, I definitely want to spend some time talking about this feature, but I'd love to also rewind everything to the beginning of Brad Bischoff and to start this conversation, learning a little bit more about your own dad. How would you characterize that relationship?
Oh, wow. Yeah. I would say strong, silent type for sure. Always sort of learned by example with my dad. He's one of the hardest workers I know. He's worked at Chul Asco since he was 16. And I feel like he has this, you know, just a total attitude of, you know, he took care of the family, you know, like he got this job when, you know, he wasn't a dad yet, but that was the job that he had when he became a dad. And then he ended up moving into managerial positions, and he's just been there ever since. And just now, actually, he's on the road to retirement, which is amazing because he's a phenomenal woodworker. He's great with his hands. He's rehabbed bathrooms in their home, and he's going to be taking on this new craftsmanship that he's had his whole life, but now he's able to sort of focus on it and pay attention to it, which I think is going to be really important for him. But I remember growing up, you know, we would connect through going to like a Chicago Blackhawks game together. Even now, it's like that's a big connection for us as sports. And I feel like that's kind of common among sons and their dads, maybe because it's something that occupies the room, you know, and so there's not a lot of emotional connection, I feel like, is something I've always sort of strived for with not just my dad, but my parents in general, wanting to be open, wanting to be vulnerable with them. But my household was kind of quiet. Emotions weren't really talked about very much. I don't know if you remember Chicken Soup for the Teenage Soul. Remember this book?
Yeah, the whole series of Chicken Soup books. Yeah.
So I must have been a teenager, but I think I was in a dentist's office or a doctor's office. But I remember I had read the first story in there while I was waiting to go in. And it was just this story about this boy who, you know, always wanted to tell his dad that he loved him. Just as simple, like, I want to tell my dad I love you. And it was so hard for him to do, and he couldn't do it. And it was something he thought about and then would go on with his day. And then so one day he said, you know what, like, you know, tomorrow I'm going to wake up and tell him I love him. And he went to bed that night, and his dad was out at work because he worked late. And his dad ended up getting into a bad car accident and died on the way home. And in the story, the boy, you know, his son woke up and was like filled with regret that he never got to do such a simple thing of saying, I love you. But for some reason, it was just so hard for him to do. And he could do it with his mom, but like with his dad, it was just different. So from that age, I just sort of made this decision that even if it's awkward or even if it feels strange, like, I'm always just going to say at the end of a phone call or when I see him, you know, I love you, Dad. I love you. You mean the world to me. And that's just something I carry with me.
Hmm. And so did you, after reading that, resolve yourself to trying that out? Or like, how did your dad receive that?
He received it well. You know, it's like, it's, there's a lot of love between us, but there's just not a lot of, you know, conversation. And I don't know if that's a product of, you know, the time, sort of like this Midwestern suburban culture or whatever, but we don't talk about religion that much. We don't talk about politics that much, but when we're together, we love being together, you know, and we have meals together and we play together. And when I started doing that, it's just, I feel like it was sort of a chance for us to be a little more open with each other. And it was definitely well received. I'm the youngest of three. I have two older brothers. And they had both moved out. So for a while, it was just me with my parents. And I got this sort of unique opportunity to, I mean, in a way, sort of, not only was I the youngest, but then there was that period there where it sort of felt like I was the only, because it was just me and my parents for maybe 5 years. We would take family trips together because my brothers would be doing other things. And it was a pretty special time. But I remember sitting at the dinner table, I think it was my, I don't know, junior or senior year. And I was just so anxious to talk, like so anxious to connect. And we were just sitting there sort of staring at the TV. And, you know, we had this food in front of us. And, you know, that's how like dining rooms are. There's like a TV somewhere nearby. And we're just sitting there. And, you know, for the most part, it was always a lot of fun. But like the older I got, the more I sort of wanted to talk. And I sort of just kind of blew up at the dinner table. And I was like, you know, how come we can't talk? Why can't we talk to each other? And we just kind of looked at each other. And there was this moment, you know, I was angsty and I kind of, you know, jumped up from the dinner table, grabbed my car keys, and I just ran out and drove through the night. It was like an, you know, 80s mixtape moment. And popped in my favorite music, and I just drove for, I don't know, hour, 2 hours. And I ended up calling home. Then we talked on the phone, and I was just like, I love you. And, I just want to talk more, and I want to be more open. And I think part of that is a difference in personalities, too. You know, can't change somebody. And so just learning a little bit more about who each other is the older we get has been pretty beneficial.
That's interesting that it was a phone call while you were driving around, you know, your suburban neighborhood that you shared this, but you didn't do it face to face, or, you know, you didn't drive back home and have this conversation. There's something about the distance or the channel that you chose that I think is interesting.
The hard thing now is like, now that I don't live at home anymore, and I don't live in the same city or even the same state anymore, we rely on phone calls to stay connected. And it's really difficult because of everything I said, you know? So it's like, we'll get on the phone and it's like, we have to talk. You know, we can't put a game on. We can't watch a movie together. We can't, you know, play sports in the backyard, which we would love to do. We have to talk. And so sometimes it kind of feels like, oh my gosh, like everything's spilling out of my mouth and I feel like I'm in a job interview and I just want you to know that like, I love you and things are going well and how are you? And it feels, you know, tense and like the hair on the back of my neck is standing up and I'm like, you know, why do I feel this way? And it's something that I'm personally working through. It's definitely not something that changes overnight.
For people listening who don't know what Jewel Osco is, it's sort of a legacy grocery store brand in the Midwest. And so your dad, not unlike my dad, who's worked at the same job my whole life, and he had this job before I was born, you know, when he was, you know, in the early days with my mom, and he will retire from that place the way that your dad is preparing to retire and to spend 40 plus 50 years at a place that like doesn't happen anymore. Like that is the last of a dying breed of worker who rises through the ranks or just does the same job day in and day out for an employer. And like the thought of ever leaving for my dad is like, what are you talking about? You know what I mean? Like, this is what you do. You commit to a place and you work your ass off for them and you're happy about that. You know what I mean? Or that's the plan, you know? And I think every job that I've taken, while supportive for sure, and I think he gets it somewhere, there's always a little bit of like, wow, so soon? You're changing jobs already? And I'm like, Dad, I've been at this place for 5 years or 6 years or whatever. And he's like, yeah, no, I understand. You know, it's a different industry. It's a different thing. But I think, yeah, they don't make them like that anymore.
And, you know, there's something fascinating about it too. And so much about it that I respect. And, you know, I got my work ethic from my dad. I just do it differently. You know what I mean? Without even getting into the film, it reminds me of the fable, The Grasshopper and the Ant, where the ant works all year long, you know, and is prepared for winter. And then there's the grasshopper that uses summer to play and sing and dance. And he doesn't store food. He just wants to, you know, experience. And then when winter comes, he's not prepared. He doesn't have anything. And he has to ask the ant, you know, for shelter, for food. And so the ant lets him in, and then in turn, the grasshopper has to perform his music for all the ants in the colony. And that's like the trade-off, is like the grasshopper has to use his art to, you know, to work and, you know, provide entertainment for the ants. When you think about this work-life culture, and it's the Alan Watts, do you listen to Alan Watts at all? He's like one of my favorite philosophers, but his whole thing is we're raising you know, children with this idea that we do one thing to get to the other. Like we go to elementary school to get to high school, to get to college, to get a degree, to get the job, to rise up the ranks in that job. And the whole time we're waiting for a sense of fulfillment or an end, like to feel like we reached it. And then by the time we feel like that, we're 60 and we realize that we missed it and that it's been happening this whole time and that life is a musical and we're supposed to be singing and dancing while the music is being played. And I remember hearing that, and that's how I try to live my life. That's what I try to do. And it's difficult, but the idea of structure versus spontaneity, you know, they both have their merits, but if you're tied to just one of them, it's frustrating, man. I don't think there's an easy answer for it.
I'm curious if, you know, you mentioned work ethic, you mentioned he hasn't been able to spend a lot of time in it, but this idea of craftsmanship from your dad, are there any other things from either what he does for a living or hobbies that influenced your early creative pursuits?
I mean, I just remember when I was younger and he was always working, man. You know, he doesn't take a break. And there's one part of me that, you know, he's always taking care of his family and always taking care of the people around him. And I always thought that was so admirable. And then, of course, there's the other hand where it was like, you know, sit down, you've earned it, take a break. And he's a huge golfer. And I've tried getting into golf almost just as a way to spend more time with him. You know, he gave me a set of clubs and we would just play the course together. And I was never really that good. But, you know, just spending time with him was always just fun. It was just fun. And again, sort of doing it. I think golf is the perfect example of like, you know, we're going to go play a sport together, but it's also a sport where we get to walk and talk through 18 holes, you know, and, you know, it's also socially acceptable to have a beer at 10 o'clock in the morning and, you know, kind of drive around in our golf cart and just, you know, and just talk and connect. And that was really fun. That was really fun. And I want to do it more.
You came up rollerblading. You've mentioned it was making skate videos that got you into video making and ultimately led to film school and everything else. And so at one point you wanted to pursue rollerblading full time. Right? Like you want, like,
yeah,
you're
totally.
You're going to get a deal to be like a sponsored athlete. So walk me through kind of telling your folks, like, how did that all go?
I think it was in middle school, sixth, seventh grade or something like that. And we couldn't afford ice hockey, but we played roller hockey. So, you know, I was in roller hockey leagues, street hockey leagues. And then I noticed one guy on our hockey team didn't have the brakes on. And I was like, oh, how did you do that? And he's like, well, I have an Allen wrench. Check this out. And he sort of, you know, took off my back brakes. And then I noticed that he had like little grind plates on his skates. And I, you know, needless to say, we became friends. I soon stopped playing roller hockey and I got my first pair of aggressive skates. And that's all I did. I'd go to school. And as soon as I get out of school, I would just go skate. My first job was at a skate park. And it was the biggest skate park in the Midwest. What it meant was I got to skate for free. So when they closed at like 10 o'clock, I got this massive indoor playground to myself. And I would just put on my favorite music and I would just freaking skate and train and just do whatever I wanted to do. And it was magic. And then I started filming it, you know, I started grabbing a camera. At this point, I was in high school. You know, and I had one class where it was like a media arts class or something. And they had these little portable, you know, three chip digital camcorders and naturally started filming skating. I had heard of a friend who made like a what's called a sponsor me tape where, you know, back in the day, it wasn't unheard of to make a sponsor me tape and just send it into these companies and just pray that you get like a letter in the mail. But I didn't want to make just another sponsor me tape. Like I didn't want to be just another kid who's like, oh, here's all my skating. Like I wanted to make it like a movie. I just started thinking about it differently. Like I'm going to do this handrail and I'm going to leave frame to the left and that's going to cut into this next shot, you know, and I just started piecing it together and naturally found a rhythm of directing, of editing and looking out for a bigger picture of a vision of this thing. and put together this tape. And we sent it in and I got my first sponsor deal. It was free skates from, like, at that time, the biggest skate company that was coming out with, like, the most hyped rollerblade. And I was like, wow, like, maybe this is a thing that can happen. Like, can people live like this? And I got those skates and I remember sitting my parents down and I was just kind of like, you know, I think I want to do this full time. I know I still have a year left or 2 years left of high school, but, you know, I think I should drop out and I should just keep skating. And, you know, naturally they were like, you're crazy. But bless their hearts, they listened to me. Like, we sat down at the dinner table and we had a conversation about it. That's why I have so much respect for my parents, because they've seen me do things like that and have conversations like that. And they listened to me, let me go through it. I think my mom's words were like, you know, think about it some more and we'll have another conversation about it, you know? And of course I woke up and I'm like, I can't drop out. That's ridiculous.
but how cool they gave you space and in that moment, you know, took you seriously and actually listened and just cut you off and say, Brad, are you insane? God, there's no way you're going to do it. Blah, blah, blah. Like,
yeah, you know, and their parenting technique is like, they let me figure it out. They didn't tell me who to be or how to think. This sort of leads into Columbia, because my brother had gone to the Illinois Institute of Art. I naturally assumed that I was just going to follow in my brother's footsteps and that's where I was going to go. And I did. I took a summer program there for like 2-3 months. I quickly realized that that is not where I wanted to be. I want to make movies. I want to chase that. And not that you have to go to school to make movies, but I wanted to be around other people who were doing it. I wanted to have access to equipment. I wanted to learn. I wanted to watch as many things as I could watch. And I started looking online and I found Columbia College Chicago. I'd always been fascinated with the city, you know, especially as a suburban kid. And I wanted to get in there. By this point, I had already graduated high school. So like all of that was over. I had gone to Illinois Institute of Art for 2 months that summer, took myself out of the program. So I had nothing, you know, and I had to go get a job. Believe it or not, I went and I took a job at an adult diaper warehouse. And I was working there full time packaging adult diapers, like Depends.
You know, no kidding.
I was still living at home, but, you know, I wanted to have some sort of income. And then I took this meeting at Columbia and I walked around, I toured the facility, and it was so different than, you know, than anything I had seen before. And the film building, I think it's 1104 South Wabash. And I remember walking in there and just being like, wow, you know, this is the film building. And I was like, I got to go here. Like, I want to be around this. And I found a scholarship opportunity because I knew, you know, it was too expensive. And so I remember when I was submitting that, whoever the head was there was telling me that I was a day or two late past the deadline and that I couldn't apply again until next year. And I just would not stop emailing him. I don't know if he just got frustrated or whatever, but he ended up emailing me back and just saying, you know what, fine, just send it to me and we'll give it a consideration. And he did, and then they accepted it. So I ended up getting a scholarship. It wasn't for a full ride or anything, but it was just enough to be able to get in there and be a full-time film student.
I don't know where along the path I met you, but I think I was most impressed by the fact that as a student, you were accepted into the Cannes Film Festival. And I knew that was a big deal, and I knew that, like, that didn't happen to most people. And I think it was in those early days, I just thought, I don't know a lot about this guy, but I feel like he's going places. Like, this is unique. I've watched that unfold, you know, kind of from a distance. We've collaborated on some things over the years, but it's been really cool for me to see your career take shape over this period of time and be able to say, like, I knew him when he was just a kid, you know, like I knew him when he was just a student, you know? And so I, you know, if you wouldn't mind, walk me through the balance you had to strike between literally commercial work, like directing for commercials, and the many short films and kind of experiments that you did personally. Like, what was that balance like, and how did, you know, one feed the other, and what were those trade-offs?
So my first film class at Columbia College Chicago, it was called Production One. You got to start on film. Like, you got to hand crank a Bolex. they gave you like barely anything, 200 feet of film, black and white, 16 millimeter. I remember the first roll that I shot came back totally overexposed. Everything was just white and it was devastating. But I, you know, they quickly gave me another shot. And I remember being in production one, and a lot of people in the class, I can't say everybody, but a lot of people in the class were like, I'm going to wait until I get into my directing class or, you know, my end of the year thesis to make the story I really want to make, you know, to do this film I really want to make. And, you know, this is just a test. I'm just going to go out and shoot some random stuff and, you know, just get through the class. But to me, and maybe because it's, I fought so hard to get into the school, maybe I credit it to my dad. I don't know. I just, you know, the way I looked at it was every opportunity could be my only opportunity, and I need to do the best I can with what's given to me. So they gave me that new film role, the one that wasn't overexposed yet. And I did a little more research on what the hell I was doing. And I put together what was known as Eyelids, which was like my first short film. And it was a story about this boy who lives on the inside of this girl's eye. And he's in love with her, but he's never noticed. So his only way to get her attention is at night, and he could paint her dreams on the inside of her eyelids. And then throughout the day, he's the one who's like holding her eyes open the whole time. And it's beautiful and cute at first, but then he has to like watch her fall in love with somebody else. And the story takes this dramatic turn. And but then it sort of comes full circle when you realize he's there even when they get older, even through everything. And he was sort of always there for her, even though he was never noticed. And at the end, he sort of paints her final destination when she passes on. And then you realize at the end, it's all in, you know, it's sort of like a daydream, and they're just two kids, and he's painting an eye, and they're in paint class, and he finally goes over and says hello. And that was the film I wanted to make. And to sort of convince myself to do it, I stood up in front of the class and just talked about it out loud. Well, you know, you say it out loud, it becomes real. And so when I said it out loud, it was almost like a challenge to myself. I just made myself accountable. I have to go do this thing now. That film ended up getting into the Chicago Film Festival. And I remember people were just like, whoa, like, you know, production one film went into this. And then, you know, we went to the Cannes Film Festival in France. And to me, it's just, it's a film. Like I loathed when people would call it a student film or a production one film or whatever. It's a film. And, you know, I took an opportunity to tell a story. And my next class in production two, this was maybe 6 months later, this short film called Wet. And I had no money. And it was a story about this guy who's just, water is just emitting from his entire body. It's just this weird character constantly soaked in water and trying to like live in a modern society. But, you know, he's kicked out of restaurants because he's spilling water all over the place. He can't buy a suit because he's just, everything gets wet. And it's kind of funny, but it's kind of dramatic. I convinced like a crew of five people to shoot this thing with me with no permits. We couldn't afford permits. And I wanted it to feel as real as possible. So we shot during rush hour in downtown off Michigan Avenue. And we shot this beautiful thing and came out with a really cool image and unique image. And that year we went back to Chicago Film Festival, and this time we won the Chicago Award, which was just an unbelievable feeling. It was just so surreal. And I started to meet more of the industry in Chicago through that, you know, people at agencies, more accomplished filmmakers, and starting to see what festivals were like and what this experience was like. But what was interesting is I was always living in the moment, right? Like I never had another, I didn't know what my next project was going to be. You know, I'd be having these meetings and I'd be doing these interviews and they'd be like, so what's, you know, like, what are you working on? And I would just be like, oh, I don't know. I just finished this thing and, you know, I'm still in school. And, you know, I didn't really seize the opportunities that were there. There was still something really beautiful about it, but it's like, that's, you know, that's what festivals and that kind of stuff is for, is like, you know, yes, you get the work recognized and it's great, but you know, you're looking to fund your next project or you're looking to find a new collaborator. But then, you know, the weekend passes and then I go back to school, you know, and I'm back in school and I'm like, so what am I going to do? I want to do this for a living. I want to make my life making movies. My instructor was who I consider my mentor and a really close friend of mine now, Miguel Silvera, gave me this advice, and he was just like, make one short film every year, no matter what happens. Make a film every year. There's no length, there's no limit, just stay busy. And it was as simple as that. I was like, no matter what's going on in my life, I can't lose this, because it's so easy to lose the older you get, that sense of creation, of childlike wonder. It's a choice to hold on to it. It really is. And it's hard, but that's what I would do. So for every year, I would make a new short film. Sometimes I would do a short film and a music video. And then come 2009, with several close friends of mine, we started what was originally just a collective of artists. It quickly became a production company to try to find a way to make a living doing what we want to do while also making movies and sort of constantly being around each other. And it was called Rubbish. And we were barely making any money, maybe $500, you know, every month or something. Like, it was just enough to be able to like cover rent, you know, and, you know, maybe get a beer or something. But we were happy and it was beautiful. And then this big job came through that sort of, for the first time, we were like, okay, we can make a little bit of money. You know, we'll all be living pretty well. And we, you know, it was a branded short film for Intel. And we ended up putting all of the money into the project and into making a great film, that we were right back where we started. But there was something kind of ignorant and blissful about just putting all your eggs in one basket, just to see what the hell happens to the basket and just to see what happens with the eggs. And it was a really unique experience, because we kind of got to do whatever we wanted to do. And I was so bullheaded, you know, I'd never worked with an agency. I'd never worked in a commercial space. And I basically wrote a short film that took place inside of an old crashing hard drive. And at the end, it was sort of like all of these memories live on this hard drive, and the whole place is going up in flames because this hard drive fell, and now everything has to be transferred off. It's funny, because looking back, it's super dramatic and like dark and scary. And there's like a Thanksgiving room where there's like a photo of a Thanksgiving dinner, and like this character's entire family is like about to be burned alive in this room. And it's like, it's craziness. And I remember taking a phone call, I guess, which is like my first director's call with the group from Intel. I was at like a film festival in Denver at the time. So I was probably super high on myself, and my new short film had just screened. And, you know, I walked outside to take this conference call, and they were like, you know, we've read the script. It's kind of long. It's like, is it going to be like a 7-minute kind of, I'm like, yeah, it's going to be it's a short film. I think it's going to be a cool way to sort of get a different kind of audience. And they just kept asking questions like, well, do you think it's a little, you know, it's a little dark? Like, is, you know, do you think we should tie in the product a little bit more? And I just kept, you know, I was like, no, it's going to be great. It's going to be fine. You know, trust me, and this and that. And somehow they never fought back, and they just let us do whatever we wanted to do. I have regrets about the final product, but, you know, on the other hand, it was kind of cool to be able to figure it out for myself. You know, like at the end of that experience, I was kind of like, yeah, I would have done things a little bit differently, but it was pretty cool to be able to just go gung ho on something and see what the hell happens. You know, the good thing is that we got the views they wanted, so we left on good terms. And from there, we kind of got like one sort of big job every year for like the next 4 years. That was sort of how we survived. And when we weren't making a commercial or doing something like that, we were making short films and putting all of our time and energy into making art. The one thing that I think was interesting about our company was we didn't just do random commercials. It was like we always attempted to put in a story or, you know, a cinematic edge, trying to push outside of just a 30-second thing. Like, how can we use the internet to our advantage? How can we tell something a little bit longer? And that was sort of our model, I guess.
Yeah, I remember reaching out to the team for a project that I was leading at Gravity Tank, and had enlisted you guys to help with some video work to tell a story. And it was for a government/healthcare client, and they were pretty buttoned up. And I remember getting the treatment back from you, and I had a similar conversation as the team from Intel did, but I was like, okay, Brad, I love this vision, man, but like, what the fuck are we talking about here? Like, this is so fantastical, and like, how are you gonna pull this off? And like, it was awesome, but I think I was nervous that I couldn't sell it to my client. And I thought, like, man, if I can't sell it, I'm not going to put Brad up to this either. And so I was like, can you give it, like, this is fine, I'll share this one, but can you give us like an alternative version that's like kind of grounded in reality and like a little less fantastic? And you did. And it was great. We made that and I'm proud of that work. And, you know, I think the client loved it and it was a great chance to collaborate. But I guess I say that to say your work, whether commercial or, you know, your own personal work as a writer and director, has always had a nostalgia or fantasy component, like something that borders on, is this real life or is this a dream, you know, or is this reality or is there like an unreliable narrator here and I'm getting like a filtered version of reality? Can you speak to that component or that attribute of your work?
A lot of my films are character studies that follow somebody usually over the course of a day or a night. And I love for it to become surreal because I have this sort of belief that people are obsessed with this other side of themselves, of what they could be or what they should be. And, you know, if you have a moment to experience that, is it any better than what you're doing now? And a lot of my work is nostalgic. I have a hard time sort of letting go of things, and that's something in my personality, I think, that I've always wrestled with.
You know, you opened the conversation talking about your dad and wanting to almost insert emotion in conversation where it wasn't or where it didn't come easy. And I feel like when you control the narrative and imagery of your films, you can do that. You can insert nostalgia or emotion or conversations about these kinds of things just the way you want them. And you can kind of design that to be however you like. And
you know, it's interesting with Where the Buffalo Roam, making that film with my brother was sort of a way that I used my art to connect with somebody close to me. We also both acted in it together and it was this like cathartic experience. And, you know, is it a documentary? Is it a narrative? In a way, doing that film was sort of like having that emotional conversation with my brother that I always craved, you know? So the whole film, my character wears this backpack. And there's the scene in the gym where we've been out all night doing all these, you know, crazy things. We broke into this school and here we are in the gym. And I sort of finally take this backpack off. It's the symbolism of carrying this emotion around everywhere you go with this person. And I took it off in that scene and I felt like I finally got to say something to him without the dullness of words. You know, it was just a physical moment. I don't think I could ever find the right words in a lot of moments in my life, but especially to my brother. And so it's just a physical thing. It was kind of like this, just this end of a chapter. And it was a pretty special thing to be able to do with him.
So you made a number of things and did you adhere to your mentor's wise words to make a short film every year? Is that, have you kept up with that record?
Yeah, you know, I feel like I really have. And if I realized that I couldn't get a production off this year, like I couldn't get, or I didn't have a script together because I never wanted to rush something if it didn't feel right, I started sort of making found footage films. You know, it'd be like an editing exercise. And I would be cutting together stories with footage from YouTube about specific events. So like there's a fire that broke out in 1980 at the MGM Grand Hotel in Las Vegas. And it was this crazy moment in reality. And I kind of wanted to use that as a story to write sort of a fictionalized story about a couple who was staying in a room at that hotel. And it was like a voiceover driven film. And I'd always sort of be doing stuff like that. And, you know, not really knowing what for other than it felt good. And it was a way to try a new storytelling technique and to write and to get something out there. And then, you know, that played at Las Vegas Film Festival. So it was like, you know, always just finding a way to stay busy and stay connected to the industry in some way. But the next sort of, you know, produced short film I did was Nomad. But Nomad was a very unique sort of moment because I was about to become a dad. Mireia was pregnant. Everything I felt like was on the brink of adulthood in a way. I felt like a lot of things were about to change, but I didn't know how. I didn't know in what way. And I was totally restless and hungry for, where Mireya and I wanted to be in life, where I wanted to be with my career. And I had grown up seeing my parents have this beautiful structure and this happy marriage. And Mireya and I were happy together. And, you know, but we're living paycheck to paycheck and been chasing this thing for a long time. And, you know, we're sort of just getting our lives started. And it was like, oh my goodness. And, you know, now you're pregnant and we're about to become parents. And I sort of popped off this one last short film and it was called Nomad. It takes place at a dinner party with this middle-aged couple and their friends are about to come over. And before they come over, the husband just wants to leave. Like he just wants to go, like, you know, free himself from all these plans, all these responsibilities and just go for a drive with his wife. And she convinces him that they can't because they've made these plans and there's people about to show up. And so it was a story about just sort of feeling stuck by your own doing, you know, feeling like you have all this hunger for what else is out there. But then in a negative way, you're ignoring all of this beauty that's unfolding right in front of you. Like you have these beautiful friends coming over. You're about to have this dinner together, but you're, you know, this character is just so stuck in his own head. I mean, in the film, he never even takes his jacket off. Like I love doing symbolic sort of gestures like that with my character and where the buffalo roam with a backpack. And then with Nomad, this guy wears a jacket indoors zipped up, you know, the whole movie until the very end, he sits down at the dinner table and takes his coat off and he's got it for the first time, he's smiling. And there's no clear resolution other than the fact that he took his coat off and they're about to eat dinner. And that's sort of the end. You know, I don't think there's clear resolution in life. And so a lot of my films don't have clear resolution in them. It's just complicated. And I like to showcase characters hopefully going through something relatable and talk about it. You know, I craved those conversations growing up. And like you mentioned, I think a lot of my films sort of try to tackle them through love, through relationships, through anxiety. A lot of my films sort of talk about that stuff.
You mentioned that, you know, Nomad was the last short you made before becoming a dad. What was it like when you found out that you were having a kid?
Wow. Well, I guess maybe I should go back a little further too and talk about how I met Mireya real quick. At the last minute, I had been invited to this sort of party. They were going to be screening a couple of my short films. And it was sort of like an art loft party in Chicago. But I didn't notice anything but this woman there who was just across the room. I showed up and I saw her right away. I had been single for a couple of years and, you know, I wasn't looking to be in a relationship. You know, I had all the time in the world to sort of do whatever I wanted to do. And then I saw this woman across the room. And I think it's funny because she was with a child. She was with a little boy who maybe was 5 years old. My first thought was, oh, wow, she's married to one of my friends here and she's a mom. And how beautiful. Like I'd always craved sort of like that maturity, you know what I mean? I was going out a lot, probably drank too much. And I always sort of craved this idea of being happy and situated with, you know, in a, you know, sort of like a relationship with somebody. And, you know, I'd always thought about parenthood, but, you know, it wasn't even on my radar. Anyway, I sort of like, okay, I can't talk to her. She's, you know, she's taken or whatever. And then all of a sudden this song comes on and she's out there like dancing all by herself. It's like that movie moment, like go out there, just start dancing. And so I ran out there and started dancing in the middle of the place with her. And it was magic. It was total magic. I never touched her once. Like we just danced around each other. You know, I felt like all eyes were just like on us. And it was like the music was just getting louder and we didn't even know each other's names. And after the dance, we walked outside, found out that night that she was single and that she was actually nannying somebody's little boy. We talked outside and I think she said, give me a toast, you know, like give me a toast. And I said, if for whatever reason we find ourselves becoming lost at sea, may we never forget why we decided to set sail in the first place. She looked at me like I was crazy. And she was like, you know, I don't want to know how many people you've used that on. And, you know, it's this funny moment. And I'm like, I swear it's the first time. And we toasted each other. And And then she kind of went away and was talking to other people. And anyway, long story short, I walked up. I'd never done this in my life, but I walked up and she was in the middle of a conversation with like several of her friends. Again, I had just met her an hour ago. I walked up to her, you know, sort of tapped her shoulder. She turned around and I just kissed her. I was like, this is either going to be the worst decision I've ever made. She's going to hit me and I'm going to be a pig. And maybe I still am a pig, but, or it's going to be the story that, you know, I talk about years later about to my kids, how I met your mother. And she looked at me and she was like, are you serious? And I just looked at her and I just kissed her again. And then she grabbed my hand and we walked over away from the party. And then we got to know each other and our dates were just as crazy, you know, full of passion, full of romance. You know, the highs are really high, the lows are really low. And 3 months in, I asked her to marry me. You know, we ended up getting married later that year. So a year from when we started dating, we became parents. A year after that is when our daughter arrived.
I'm so glad that you gave me that context and you didn't just answer my question. Wow, man, hold on. We need to pause. I just want everybody to know, like, if you knew these two people, this story would not feel like weird or gross. It would feel like a scene from a movie where that's exactly how it's supposed to happen. I don't imagine that either of you have any kind of weirdness, regret, or feelings about that moment, other than like that was a crazy start to what has been a crazy relationship with a lot of passion and heart. And so I want to make that clear. So yeah, you're talking about struggling to make ends meet and doing commercial work to fund your passion projects or your independent films and this sort of cycle that worked fine in the days of Rubbish and Strange Loop and being independent. And now there's two people trying to be adults. And in the midst of that, you're about to bring a whole human into the world.
Yeah, this will be a good transition to talking about how my work life changed too. You know, we had just closed Rubbish. We had ended the production company amicably between all of us. I think we just, you know, we wanted to try a different avenue, a different way. So I was freelance. I had been freelance for, I don't know, 6 months to a year maybe. When I found out, I remember we were in bed. We were living in Ravenswood at the time. And it was the middle of the night. Mireya had woke up and went to the bathroom. And at 2-3 o'clock in the morning, she comes back and she just had this smile on her face. And she's just like, I'm pregnant. And this like load of bricks just like fell on my head. It sounds like a horrible thing, but like not in a bad way. Like I was just stoned. Like I didn't know how to react. I didn't know what to say. I think I just hugged her and I just kissed her. And I was like, wow. You know, we had been trying to have a baby and it hadn't been working. And I know it sounds like everything is moving so fast, but you know, we had gotten married and we had been trying and we were excited about the idea of parenthood and wanted to explore that together. So when she told me that, it was like, wow, like it happened, like it's happening. So we just stayed up all night until the sun rose, just talking about this idea of parenthood and also not wanting to get too excited because there's that moment in pregnancy that you got to get past. You know, we didn't have health insurance. We were still living paycheck to paycheck and just, you know, we just talked about all of that, but we talked about all of it with love. It wasn't with stress. It was with love. And I think that created a very positive atmosphere for a baby to grow. And so the first thing I did the next day is I needed to find work and I needed to find work as soon as possible. So I could type fast. I write a ton of screenplays. I was like, I'm going to go be a typist. And I found a job typing court cases and transcribing detective interviews with crazy cases, like murder cases. Like it was insane, but you had to type 80 words a minute. And I was like, ooh, I could do 100. Then I could keep writing my scripts on the side. Mireya was still a waitress. She can still work. And they made me take a typing test in front of the person there. It was hilarious. I think I ended up clocking like 110 words a minute or some craziness. And so they gave me the job on the spot. And so I started doing that all the way up until January. our daughter was born January 23rd. So we're almost a month away. I was making $15 an hour, which is an honorable, you know, wage, but I wanted to have health insurance and benefits and a salary. And, you know, for the first time in my life, I craved all of those things. I'd never wanted that sort of predictability. I'd never wanted that structure. But at this moment, on the brink of becoming a dad, it's all I could think about. And maybe that's because that's all I knew growing up. And so I cornered my friend at a New Year's Eve party. His name's Gus Covino. I never forget it. And I grabbed Gus by the shirt. And I'm just like, you know, because he worked at an agency and he was an editor and a director. And I was like, Gus, you got to get me in. You got to get me in. Like, I need a job. I need something. Like, I'm about to become a dad. And he was just like, you know, I think the agency that I'm working at is going to have interviews next week. And, you know, we're expanding and we need somebody. The following week, I went and I took an interview and it went very well. And they gave me the job.
Just in the nick
of time.
It
was crazy, man. It was crazy. I was always of the mindset, like, I'll get in through any door or window I need to get in. And I just need a ticket to the party. And then once you're in the party, talk to whoever the hell you want to talk to and, you know, make your way to the buffet. It ended up being one of the best decisions I ever made. It was something I was so afraid of. 9 to 5, weekends off, 2 weeks vacation, salary, and all that stuff always scared the hell out of me. Like, I didn't want it. But then when I had it, at that moment in my life, it was everything we needed to set our sail, to get us going. And I met some of the finest people in the industry that I know. You know, they really helped me live. They helped me take care of my family. And even though that lifestyle has its own stresses, for what it was very beautiful.
You know, you described the moment you found out, which in and of itself is like a little vignette, you know, the way that you described
yeah.
it. And then this realization in sort of 9 months leading up to it, you squeeze out one last short and you're kind of coming to grips with like, this is maybe not sustainable, or at least like, I don't want to start things off with what might have worked for us when we were
exactly
not parents, but now it's like, I want to do something different. And even if that is in some ways like swallowing my pride and taking this scary agency thing, which turns out to be this thing that sustains you through some of these hardest moments of early parenthood, early fatherhood, how would you characterize what went through your mind with regards to your work, the non-commercial work, the work that you'd been doing up to that point?
I guess I'll just preface by saying, the whole time Mita was pregnant, I had written the feature that I'm working on now, The Grasshopper. Like, I had written that during the 9 months she was pregnant. And I'd always been talking about it. I've been working on it for years, even before that. You know, I put the script aside and I took that job and kind of put everything to the side. And I was like, time to be a dad, time to enjoy being a dad, time to see what it feels like to be a dad. I had no idea. And Mireya gave birth at a freestanding birth center. From the very beginning, she sort of opened my eyes into what birth could be, what it was. I just assumed, oh, we're going to give birth in a hospital. And here I am witnessing Mireya, you know, free of medical intervention, free of drugs and everything, just a woman giving birth. And it was the craziest thing I'd ever seen. And I was there, I was rubbing her the whole time. I was massaging her shoulders and saw her do this thing. I mean, it'll never leave my mind, those memories. We also didn't know if Everest was going to be a boy or a girl. We wanted it to be a surprise. And so then Everest pops out and she's a girl. And I was just like, oh my God, I just assumed it was going to be a boy, you know, because I have two older brothers. And again, like, just slapped in the face with, whoa, dude, you know, you just had a daughter, you know, and not knowing anything. The craziest thing is then watching everybody in the room leave. And it's just Mireya, me, and our daughter. And we're just on this bed. And now we're parents. And nobody told us, like, how we're supposed to feel, what we're supposed to do. And we're just looking at this alien in between us, like, so now we have to take care of this thing. And everybody left. And how do you sleep? How the hell do you sleep? How do I go to work? How am I ever going to make a film again? How will our lives ever be what they used to be? And that was the very beginning. It's crazy, man. It's crazy. But that was the beginning.
Yeah. You've got this good thing going on. You've committed to the agency, kind of creating a little more safety net, security, you know, all the things that come with full-time work. And then at some point, you up and leave all the comforts and familiarity of Chicago and you go to California. So what happened, and tell me about that decision.
Yeah, well, I guess it was part of our parenting philosophy from the beginning was that we wanted to feel like our kids were joining the party, you know, like they're coming along for the ride. Again, this is our idealistic younger selves, but we didn't want to feel like we were going to change our life philosophy to just revolve around our kids, because we felt that would create resentment, not only in each other, but in ourselves, that we're not living life the way that we want to live it. And that just because we had kids doesn't mean that we have to give up on all of these things that we wanted to do for ourselves. I feel like I've met so many people over the years where it was like, oh yeah, I used to be an artist and then I had kids. And, you know, then all of a sudden it's the Alan Watts thing. They wake up, they're 60. It's kind of like, well, what just happened to the last 30 years? So even though it was going to be difficult, it was like, you know, we want to actively pursue our passions. Everything we want to do with a full heart. We don't ever want to feel like we're doing something just because we have to do it. So while amazing as that job was, ultimately, there's other things that I want to do. I want to make movies, and I want to be on those director calls. I want to direct. I want to make commercials, and I don't want to be behind a desk Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. In order to make that move happen, though, 6 months prior to that, we left our apartment in Ravenswood to go live with my parents in the suburbs, and I commuted in to the agency job. And our whole family sort of lived in one bedroom in my parents' house, you know, so we could save money. And we drove across the country in, I think, 6 days. By now, Everest is like a year and a half, maybe. And Mita is like, you know, 6 months pregnant. And we get to her parents' house. And then we lived with her parents for 6 months while we got on our feet, while I started to look for work. And Mireia actually outdid herself, and she gave birth right there in the house, in the bathroom, in the bathtub. And it was the most craziest thing I've ever seen in my life. She labored at home. We went for a walk, and then she was like, okay, like I'm about to, like, I feel it happening. And, you know, we had a midwife, and she was there, and in total, it was 2 hours later, you know, River just jumped out like a fish in a bathtub, man. Like, it was crazy. And then there were four.
Man, that's wild. And sticking with your pacing of a short film, or, you know, a project like that a year, I'm curious if a feature length, does that like buy you a couple years of not having to make anything?
Well, you know, maybe if I could redo some things, I would have kind of calmed down a little bit, but I didn't calm down. Like, as soon as we arrived, as a way to sort of get to know my father-in-law more, Roberto, I asked if he would make a movie with me, like a little short film. And the year before that, I made a short film with Mireia's sister called Lady of the House about motherhood. And it was when I was a dad, you know, we had had Everest, and I sort of wrote the story about an opera singer who gave up singing to become a mother and take care of her kids and become a stay-at-home mom. It's exploring a character who's began to identify themselves through their children. And it ends on sort of that conflicting note of, yes, my life is beautiful, but yes, my life is haunted and it's complicated. And there's things inside me that are unfulfilled. And then when we moved to California, I had asked Roberto if he would do a little short film with me. And so as a way to sort of get to know my new environment, my new home for now, and my father-in-law, we sort of did this little portrait together. And I think that's also sort of been, I was going to say problem, but I think disease is probably a better way to put it, because it's the thing that is a part of me, and it's difficult to fix. Like, I can't stop. And there's been a lot of points of contention, of me sort of feeling, absent, of me sort of feeling like Mireya says this thing where everything I do, I put my all into it. Like I love everything into the ground is what she says. Like if I have a pair of boots, I wear them until the soles are dead, like destroyed. I go all the way with love, with fatherhood, with my films. But the problem with that is that if one aspect of my life is going really well, it means that there's another aspect of my life that's suffering because of it. So when there are those moments that my film career is soaring, I know that, you know, my responsibilities at home are suffering.
Yeah. You, when we talked leading into this, you'd said, you know, your show is about these men who have found that balance or are at least successful in being both dads and creative people. And you'd said like family and work life have been extremely difficult. And like, I don't know if your show is about the struggle, but that's kind of what I'm in, you know? And I think you even used the, you know, some sort of phrase of like being like at the brink or on the brink. And, you know, you're in the thick of a feature length project, which you've never done before. It's not something you're shooting in California. You're shooting it back in Chicago. And I could tell, I was like, one, if you're comfortable, really important, because I think that's the kind of stuff that people don't talk about or they get past and kind of move on. And so I was at once kind of excited to have that perspective because I think it's missing. And, you know, on a more like personal level, if I could give you space to explore that, you know,
absolutely.
I wanted to try to do that because there'll come a time when your kids maybe listen to this or you have those kinds of conversations. And to your earlier point, like, I can't think of anything sadder than wasted talent. And to hear, you know, a parent or an adult say like, oh yeah, I used to make art or I used to dance or I used to do these things. And then I had kids or then you were born and I just stopped. And
like, it's awful. It's awful. Yeah,
it is. I mean, it's at the root of the show. And so when you use a phrase with me that says, Antonio, it feels like every day I'm like winning her back talking about your wife. Tell me about that intersection.
Well, I almost lost her. Oh, man. And, you know, she's the love of my life, man. And I was so close to losing her. Because it's just, it's so hard to whittle down just how complicated parenthood is and how it affects your relationship before you had kids. And then on top of that, like I make a joke out of it, but the disease of being an artist, it's like, I have so many things that I want to do, but there's the stresses of financial security. There's the stresses of trying to keep our love alive. There's the stresses of raising human beings. And there's the hunt. There's the hunt of, you know, I've been freelance now for going on 3 years. When I left the agency, I've been able to make it work, but it's not without its sacrifices. And there's been times where I feel like a shadow of a father. Like I feel like I'm missing moments. Like I missed Halloween, and you know, it's just not even that I like Halloween, but it's like I missed seeing my kids dress up for Halloween and taking them trick-or-treating. And it's like, oh man, I gotta take a second. There's these sacrifices that you make, and I've been working on this feature for so long, and it was finally happening. It was finally happening. I've been working on it for like 5 years, and I was on the verge of like a nervous breakdown. And I should be so happy because this thing is finally happening. I'm here. We flew in, you know, our lead actor from Palestine because I had a feeling about him. Like I loved him as an actor. And, you know, he's this international star, and we fucking flew him in around the world to Barrington, Illinois. And our lead actress, Eva, you know, we flew her in from New York, and, you know, everybody's coming in for this thing, and it's the words of the page are jumping to life, and we're filming the movie. And my personal life is in shambles. My marriage is crumbling. I'm feeling like an absent father. I'm, you know, overindulging in vices and, you know, stereotypically, it just sounds like all the tropes of a starving artist, you know what I mean? And sadly, it's exactly where I was. And I know it doesn't even sound like that long. It's like a month and a half, 2 months, but it had been building for years, this sort of lifestyle, this sort of, oh, I'm just going to go do this short film. You know, I remember we were on vacation once and I did a short film on vacation and it was just like, what the fuck am I doing? Like, why am I doing this? Like, why aren't I just enjoying my time with my family? I was always sort of looking for another thing to do. And I don't know if it was a sort of escapism or just this desire to create, but it's very difficult for me to turn it off. And it just, it finally was just reaching, no, it wasn't reaching. It had reached a boiling point. And we were talking about living in separate places and talking about co-parenting. And I never thought that I would end up here. I never thought that I would be having these conversations, especially with the amount of passion that, you know, her and I have. And I just kept saying, I'm like, you know, if you were here in person, I need to see your face. Like when you're saying these things, like you need to say it to my face. You know, here we are on the phone and there's this distance and it's so much easier to just throw it all away. And you need to be here. Like you need to be here. Come out here. Come out here. Let me fly you out here for the last week, for the last week of production. She said to me, she's like, I'm 2 feet out the door and I'm looking back at you. And I remember just sitting there on the phone and I was just like, you're looking back at me though. You know what I mean? I was like, why are you looking back at me? Like there's something you must like looking at. And I sort of made a joke like that. And she started laughing. And I was like, for 5 weeks, like I've had to use my words, like only my words. And so I ordered a dinner from like a local restaurant that she liked. You know, I'm in Chicago, she's in California. And I looked up the number and, you know, I had her favorite dinner, you know, delivered to the apartment. You know, I ordered her a plane ticket and I ordered a ticket for the kids and anything I could do to show her, I'm still interested. I know you think I'm crazy. I know you think I don't care about you, that all I care about is my movie. But like, that's not true. And that's just what's going on right now. And, you know, I don't want to lose you. You mean the world to me. And I've been pouring my heart and soul into this film at the same time. And there's so much I've written in it that's about us, that's about our struggle, that's about how I feel about the world, about money, about work, parenthood, relationships, and ultimately how I feel about Medea. And then the toast, there's the toast that I gave her if we ever find ourselves becoming lost at sea. And I told her, I haven't forgotten why we set sail. I have not forgotten. So she said, okay, I'll come out. And so she came out with the kids. And they were there for the last week of production. And I remember, and it's how I always dreamed of it, that we would wrap this, you know, my sort of first feature and that I would be there with her and that my kids would be there. And that's how it happened.
Yeah, I'm glad that that happened. I really am.
It was nuts, man.
Thank you for being honest about all of that and being willing to come on the show in spite of being in the thick of production and, you know, everything that's going on at home and your willingness to share that and be open about that. It means a lot to me.
You know, what's crazy is during that last week, just picture the most stress, you know what I mean? And it was like, we had to raise a couple more thousand and I didn't even tell you, it was River's birthday on Monday, that last week of production. And I had been just pouring my entire being into this project. And it was like, I'm taking Monday off to celebrate my son's birthday. And that was so important to me. I didn't care if we needed that day. I didn't care if we had, if it meant we were going to, you know, lose this location or whatever. I'm taking Monday off so that I could be dad. And that's what I did. And everybody understood that on the set. And so everybody took a day off. And I got to spend that time with Medea, with Everest, and celebrating River's birthday. And the day had been beautiful. Like we had, we had played, we went and had a great lunch together. We, you know, got a cake and, you know, then Medea and I got a coffee and we're talking and we're sitting there in this mall and we're watching the kids run around a mall directory board laughing. And I'm just sitting there watching them. And I had been so stressed about money, about the film, about Mireya and I, just about life. And I'm just watching the kids laughing, running around a mall directory board. It could all be so simple. And I let everything go. I finally got out of my head and they just snap you back to reality. And I just fell in love with the moment with being a dad. It was a really powerful thing. And when we wrapped the film and I had this pain in my stomach and I found out my body was shutting down and I had to have this emergency surgery and it immobilized me for a week. And I think that was the universe telling me to remember what I felt at the mall when I was sitting there just watching my kids, to just sit there, heal, and be a dad. And that's where I've been, you know, for the last week and a half. So maybe you're catching me at a good time. But I've just been forced to stop hustling. I've been forced to stop creating and just embrace fatherhood and life and my relationship. And it's been a really beautiful time.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the Dadwell podcast. If you were inspired by what you heard, please take a few minutes to write a review on iTunes. As a new podcast, this helps a ton and would mean a lot to me. Dadwell is on Twitter, Instagram, Medium, and all the other relevant social networks. So visit dadwell.co to find links to all of those. While you're there, you can also subscribe to the Dadwell newsletter, check out some helpful resources and books, and even cop some fresh Dadwell merchandise. Additionally, you can support this project by becoming a patron via patreon.com/dadwell. That's patreon.com/dadwell. Thanks so much for listening. My name is Antonio Garcia, and we'll talk again soon. Cheers.